Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Fair Assessment of Real Estate Association against McNary. Mr. Neuberger, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. In 1974, David and Lynn Cassily bought a new home in St. Louis County, Missouri. In 1975, they, with other citizens of St. Louis County, initiated a series of litigations in the state court system to attempt to obtain a reassessment of real property taxes in St. Louis County and in the state of Missouri. A series of decisions by the state courts have been rendered on that subject, and a process of reassessment is now under legislative and court mandate going forward in the state of Missouri. In the middle of the process of raising the issue of reassessment in the state of Missouri, the Cassilys, together with a citizen organization in which they were involved, initiated this action, a 1983 action, in which they sought damages against certain state and county officials for what they viewed as a violation of their constitutional rights. Particularly, they alleged two violations of rights. First, they alleged that they had been placed in a category or classification of homeowners that was separate from homeowners in general, that is, new homeowners, and that as new homeowners, their real property was assessed at the rate of 33 1/3% of its fair market value, when other homeowners were assessed on average at a prevailing rate of approximately 22% of its fair market value. Secondly, they alleged that in the course of appealing certain assessments over the years, and particularly in one particular year, they were successful in their appeal and their assessed value was reduced, but that they and everybody else who had appealed in that year through the state process had been automatically called up for reassessment in the second year, thus that they were put in a classification of people who had exercised their right to appeal, and when people exercised their right to appeal, they were separated into a separate class and subjected to a reassessment that raised them back to where they had been assessed in the first place.
Mr. Neuberg, is there any issue here whether your complaint stated a cause of action in 1983?
I do not believe that anybody has seriously challenged whether we stated a cause of action.
I'm just wondering whether we ought not get that.
As far as I can see, we have in fact alleged a cause of action, and the district court dismissed us out exclusively on the subject of the Tax Injunction Act. And Mr. Justice Brennan, in connection with that, I would also like to narrow today's discussion in another respect. While one of the petitioners is an association of citizens, this lawsuit has been determined solely on the basis of the Cassily's claim. And the question that we come down to is the interest today of these homeowners in their right to pursue their 1983 action in light of the Tax Injunction Act in federal courts.
In other words,
whether, in spite of the fact that the Tax Injunction Act has been extended to declaratory judgments, it should also be extended to monetary relief?
Yes. The Judge Nangle, the district court judge who heard the case, dismissed the case on the grounds, stating that this was like a tax refund action, on the grounds that the Tax Injunction Act barred this action, an action at law, for damages.
Was he suggesting, did you think, when he said it's like a tax refund action, that that, in any event, would be the limit of any 1983 damages? A refund of the excess tax?
Again, Your Honor, when one gets into a situation that a case is being decided on a motion to dismiss, it is difficult sometimes to know what facts really will be material. In petitioner's complaint, they alleged damages in excess of the amount of tax refund. And I'm speaking specifically about the Cassileys, wholly aside from fair assessment
including
and real estate.
Including punitive damages?
I'm sorry?
Including punitive?
Including, but not exclusively. We have assessed both excessive taxes and other monetary damages in some of the years of the complaint and punitive damages and seek to recover those. I think that when we have the discussion from Judge Nangle, when he says this is like a tax refund action, I think we should recognize another element of his decision. And that is, he said, compare to Younger against Harris. He said, without much analysis of what that meant, he was suggesting, I think, that the difficulty in this case is a difficulty of federalism, that it's a question of whether the federal courts, the lower federal courts, should hear a Section 1983 action at law for damages in the context of a claim that the entire process is a part of the state taxation process, which is obviously terribly important to keep within the confines of state law.
Well, that was certainly the thrust of Great Lakes versus Huffman, wasn't it? That it, just because it said injunction didn't mean that it was limited to injunction.
That's right, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. In Great Lakes against Huffman, it, of course, confined itself to the subject of declaratory judgment actions, which was the question presented. And our tradition is to recognize that declaratory judgments actions are not quite equity actions, but certainly are in a realm that is somewhat similar to equity actions. And indeed, the argument that I would present to this court is that on the language and the legislative history and the precedents like the Great Lakes case itself, that on all of those terms, that Section 1341, the Tax Injunction Act, bars the federal courts from hearing jurisdiction or from hearing cases in which the claim is for the exercise of anything in the order of equity jurisdiction. But I likewise submit that there is nothing in the statute or the legislative history or the precedents to suggest that the claim for damages should be barred.
Well, Mr. Neuberger, before we ever had 1341, I gather the jurisprudence of this court at the very least, wasn't it, you had to do administrative exhaustion in the state, and that was a jurisdictional prerequisite to a tax suit, was it not?
That's right, Your Honor.
That was Weld County, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, do you think that 1341 in any way affected that jurisdictional requirement?
I think that I do not think that the question of exhaustion was determined in any way by 1341.
So Weld County would still be good law notwithstanding 1341.
I would take the view that Monroe against Pape and the cases that followed from that have determined the exhaustion question of this matter. I certainly do not believe that the federal courts in a diversity case simply based on an argument of some inappropriate taxation or taxation contrary to state law would be able to hear that case without going through the processes of administrative exhaustion.
At 21 of your brief, you cite Matthews and Rogers.
Yes, so, Your Honor.
And the conclusion of the quotation you cite from suggests that a suit at law in the federal courts if the essential elements of federal jurisdiction are present. Now, didn't that at least contemplate that you had to exhaust your administrative remedies as a federal jurisdictional prerequisite before you could maintain a suit at law in the federal courts?
In a proper case in which the question of exhaustion of administrative or judicial remedies is presented, and certainly.
Did you exhaust administrative remedies in Missouri? Yeah.
Your Honor, the position that we take is that exhaustion is not required.
No, my question was, did you?
Well,
did you attempt to exhaust any administrative?
The trouble with the question is that, again, relates back to the facts of the case. There are a number of things that have happened. In two of the years that we have made a complaint on, we did not appeal the assessment. In two of the years that we have complained of, we did appeal and complete the appeal of the assessment.
That's an administrative appeal, is it?
That went through the administrative appeals process.
Yeah.
And in one of the years, the appeal was started, but I do not believe that it was carried to completion. But, Your Honor, I would suggest that there is another very important question here when we talk about administration or exhaustion. And that's the question of exhaustion of what? Remedies. Because the remedy that is being claimed here is the constitutional remedy to be protected from violations of the Equal Protection Clause. And I do not believe that there is any proceeding that could be had in state court other than an analogous 1983 action, perhaps, in state court that would...
Have the Missouri courts passed on whether 1983 suits may be brought in?
To be perfectly honest, I am of the opinion that it can be done in Missouri, but I don't think that it's necessarily 100% clear. But the fact remains
well, even
that...
If it does, that's right. If you could have brought your suit in state court under 1983, you say that's no answer in any event.
That's right, Your Honor, because...
You may still go into federal court.
Quite clearly under the train of cases that have developed around 1983 following Monroe against Pape, this is an election that a plaintiff has under the circumstances. The other fact that's terribly important to the question that you're pressing me on is whether, if we do proceed with our case, we actually are posing a problem with the administration of state taxes. And I think that it's very important to recognize that the case that we've prosecuted here has only minimal impact on the exercise of the taxation processes in the state of Missouri. The only thing that we are asking for is damages arising out of our constitutional breach by individual defendants, not by any public authority. We're asking for the damages from institutional defendants. And we are asking from those damages based upon the fact, as we allege, that those individual defendants, in bad faith, because, of course, there's official immunity in the picture, in bad faith
They are state
shows,
officials.
I'm sorry?
They are state officials.
They are state and county officials.
And to sue state and county officials does not interfere with their work. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. I am certain that it is possible. Well, I have no doubt but that the litigation itself has some possibility of a chilling impact on the exercise of discretion that they would pursue. I would point out to the court that the court has developed a doctrine of official immunity, Wood v. Strickland in the cases that are associated with that, which I suggest is a doctrine developed to protect state officials so that they do properly exercise their discretion.
You haven't sued the county or any municipality as such, have you?
That's right, Your Honor.
So that there's no Owen and independence problem here.
That's right, Your Honor. In fact, this case came down before the decision in it was this case was initiated before the decision in independence, but I doubt that independence would be relevant because this is an exercise of the county taxing authority, which is in a direct administrative line from state taxing authority, and I don't think that there's the presence of a municipal corporation in the circumstance to create that problem. I think that it's important to recognize, because of the official immunity doctrine, that the liability of these defendants can only be established if we establish, first, the equal protection violation, and second, that they acted in bad faith. So that when we worry about whether the officials' exercise of discretion will be hindered, the answer to that question has to be that while it may be hindered, it's in a very limited way. And it is certainly no more hindered than governors and police officers and other officials who, under the official immunity doctrine, may have some possibility of liability in some circumstances where their bad faith is established.
Mr. Newberg, may I interrupt you? The references to bad faith in this context are somewhat a little bit unusual, it seems to me. Supposing there was a statute in the state that said new homes shall be assessed at 33% of market value, and old, and after a year they shall be assessed at 20% of market value. Is it your view that that statute would violate the Equal Protection Clause?
If there were some reasonable basis for that classification,
that's all we know.
Which I...
All we know is that there's a statute that says that. And then the people who work in the tax department are trying to collect taxes on that basis.
The question, as I'm sure you recall, Mr. Justice Stevens, it relates back to the question of whether such a classification is probably arbitrary. And indeed, that's the reason that I'm using the word bad faith in this discussion. Whether such a, I would take the view that that kind of classification has no apparent justification on its face, unless there is some kind of legitimate public policy of discouraging the construction of new homes, which I have very hard time contemplating.
Well, what if the statute had a preamble reciting that the additional expense in connection with new construction, building permits, inspections, and so forth, justified this? Would you have any problem with it then?
If...
There are additional expenses for new homes.
Yes. Certainly there are expenses for new homes, including a tax that could, I mean, a building permit, which indeed could be characterized as a tax.
And building inspections.
And building inspections that could be characterized as a tax. If there were that kind of rational basis for the distinction, then it may be that the classification is not palpably arbitrary. But it seems to me that it's important for us to remember a couple of facts. One, under the law and the Constitution of Missouri, there is no classification of real property to be recognized. That's a ground rule in the state of Missouri.
Yes, but if we're talking about the federal Constitution, does it really matter to us whether the classification is made by the legislature or by the people who collect the taxes, if they do it on a uniform basis and make that particular rule?
The second argument that I would make is it arises straight out of Sioux City against Breckinridge, which is a 1923 decision of this court, and that is that if you have, by happenstance, a development in which there are some people who are assessed at a much higher rate than the prevailing rate throughout the county, that is a palpably arbitrary distinction that creates a classification that is not consistent with the Equal Protection Clause.
But this one,
clause.
By your own allegations, is not a happenstance or an accident. They have a state policy of treating new homes at one rate and older homes at a different rate, and it seems to me you've conceded that it's not palpably arbitrary.
No, I didn't mean to sort of concede.
If it was a statute, you conceded it.
I am suggesting that there are circumstances in which a program can be established in which distinction can be drawn in different kinds of real property. I would suggest that in the exact circumstances of this case, that it's necessary for me to prove in the district court, if I'm going to be heard on this case, that these classifications are palpably arbitrary. My intention in making that proof is that that what had happened was because of an absence of reassessment in the county. The county permitted old properties to continue at their level of assessment for some 20 years, and at the same time engaged in an activity of assessing new property at 33 1/3% of the fair market value of that property. Now, that, I suggest, is not a decision that was based upon a rational basis, that there is not a distinction to be drawn between that old property and the new property. I think that's exactly what the case was in Sioux City, and the court in that case taught all of us that that was a classification that was unconstitutional within the Equal Protection Clause. I think well, it's interesting. Sioux City was cited in 1978, I believe is the year, by the Supreme Court of Missouri to tell the assessors that, in fact, that is the controlling law of the land and that they ought to have either been assessing property at that lower 22% or they ought to be assessing everybody at the higher 33%. The important question, though, here is a question of federal jurisdiction. And while it is certainly fair and fair game to take after me on the question of whether I'm going to prove that equal protection violation if I'm returned to district court, that is not what Judge Nangle did in dismissing me. And what he did in dismissing me was to determine that I had that I was barred either by the Tax Injunction Act or by some analogy to the Younger against Harris doctrine.
Was there an answer in this case or just a motion to dismiss?
There are two different sets of respondents and defendants in this case.
Well, let me ask you an ultimate question. Was immunity pleaded in any of the answers?
I don't recall it.
Because I thought our qualified immunity rule under, and I think it was in a procuniae against, was it? Navarrete out of Illinois, wasn't it?
You think of Roswell, Your Honor?
No, I'm not. I'm thinking of the qualified immunity case. Unless the defendant knew or should have known that this was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, he's immune.
I believe that's right.
And we have several times said that unless the law was clearly established, especially on a constitutional basis, he shouldn't be held liable in damages.
I believe
so
that.
So I just wonder why, in this case, if you're going to have to prove, if there's any doubt about the equal protection violation, I would think the immunity defense is going to be fairly solid.
Well, I agree with that, Your Honor, except that if you go back to the history of what's gone on in this case in the state courts, I believe that the defendants fully understood that they were violating the constitutional rights of the individual.
Well, why should you?
In 1975.
You're not going to have to prove it then, I take it.
Well, that's right. But I mean, I believe that that's a matter of defense. But I mean, the defense, and certainly I expect to raise that issue in a trial. Perhaps I'm assuming that they will defend on all issues and they will not. Again,
well,
we're in a
motion. Any cases that just come right out on hold that this differential in assessment violates equal protection?
Sioux City and Breckenridge.
Yes.
Sioux City is a decision of this court in 23, yes. And Breckenridge is a decision of the Missouri Supreme Court in 78. In addition to that, there was a decision of the Missouri...
And yet the Missouri Administrative Appeals System gives you no relief. Says it isn't, I take it.
The practice of the defendants in this case has
well,
been
I know,
to continue...
You appealed it. In a couple of the years, didn't you?
And in the years that was involved, there was partial relief, but there was not total relief. In fact, if I have my years straight, in 78 there was a partial relief. In 79, the assessor's office issued a computer letter, which is incidentally in the allegations. I mean, I'm within the record here. A computer letter that said, since you got relief and your taxes were reduced last year, we're automatically raising your taxes for next year, and did not do that to anybody except those people who had exercised their right of appeal. And I must say, Justice Stevens, it seems to me that that's another classification in which I may be able to establish constitutional rights violations.
Have you ever presented the constitutional question to any Illinois authorities?
Missouri, Your Honor.
I mean, Missouri?
The entire question of whether there should be a reassessment is in the Missouri legal process, where it belongs. This case, this court and the federal district courts should not be hearing the question of reassessment as a general policy matter within the within its court.
Is the equal protection question pending in the Missouri court?
I don't know. I don't believe the question is pending at all, because I believe it was decided by the Missouri Supreme Court in Breckenridge. And in another case, which is State Etrel Cassley against Riney, and by the lower courts on numerous occasions.
Mr. Newberger, I started to have your light go on. I just wanted to ask one question.
Certainly.
If we can get back to this jurisdictional question, namely jurisdiction of the federal courts to entertain a 1983 action in cases like this. Is there anything in this quotation from Roswell? You just mentioned Roswell of last term.
Yes, Your Honor.
Page 21. In which we said it is true that post-1937 court cases have suggested that the Tax Injunction Act recognized and sanctioned the pre-existing federal equity practice. Then we said then that it was a long-standing rule of federal equity to keep out of state tax matters as long as a plain, adequate, and complete remedy could be had at law. Does that bear at all on our question here?
I believe it bears most importantly on the question in this regard. We are not raising the question or litigating the presence or absence of a plain, speedy, or adequate remedy.
So we assume that there is one.
Well, we assume that, I mean, without making inappropriate concessions. Mm-hmm. What we are arguing is that the Tax Injunction Act, which refers to the federal courts enjoining, suspending, or restraining the actions related to tax assessment, is simply unrelated to damages actions, and that the Tax Injunction Act nor the doctrines of comity, as this Court has developed them over the years, in the absence of any suggestion of a claim for the exercise of equity jurisdiction, should bar this action.
But suppose the Missouri Supreme Court were to say, yes, you may maintain a 1983 action in our state courts for the damages that you are seeking in the federal court. Would that have any relation to this?
Unless this court were to adopt a new precedent, which it has not so far done, that requires the pursuit of a 1983
action
in state court.
That's your Monroe and Pape argument.
I'm sorry?
That's your Monroe and Pape argument.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, if I may reserve some minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Mr. Chief Justice,
Mr. Worley,
please the court. I'd just like to make one comment on Mr. Newberger's statement that he felt that this case could have a chilling effect upon the tax officials of St. Louis County and of the state of Missouri. I believe that's why we're here, because we feel that this court and all the other courts, as well as Congress, that their intent was, when they passed the Tax Injunction Act, was to keep federal district courts from interfering with the collection of state taxes as far as the method, assessment, levy, and collection was concerned. And when he says that no doubt that this cause of action will have a chilling effect upon tax officials, then we submit to you that is the reason. That is the reason why Judge Nangle said what he said, because he said he could not in any way go into this lawsuit without actually becoming an appellate court in regard to the assessment of taxes in St. Louis County.
Well, Mr. Worley, yes? I got the statute, of course, in words, deals only with enjoining, suspending, or restraining, doesn't it?
Judge,
here what you have is an action for money damages. Is that an action to suspend, enjoin, or restrain?
I think it would be an action to restrain and suspend, not to enjoin, because when we look at what the meanings of those words are, restrain and to restrain and suspend. Restrain, you know, to pull the effect back. And so if any cause of action, be it an injunction suit, declaratory judgment suit, a suit for a tax refund, or just a plain damage suit like this, it's going to have the effect of pulling back what the tax official is going to do in his job.
There's a considerable difference between declaratory judgment and damages.
Yes, sir. But
so don't... The declaratory judgment case doesn't help you at all.
Judge, I think it does.
That's a declaratory. Well, the only difference between a declaratory judgment and an injunction is one piece of paper.
Well,
that's the only difference, right?
No, sir. I think.
Well, what else do you need after you get a declaratory injunction?
Well, the declaratory judgment
all
was saying...
All you need is a motion to turn it into a permanent injunction.
But the courts have looked on it as different, Judge, and I think that if we look at the history...
It's a little different between that and damages, isn't it?
There is a difference, yes, sir. But when we look at the
Can you get a declaratory judgment for damages?
No, sir.
Well, how does it help you on damages?
It helps us on damage for this reason. I submit to the court that when the Tax Injunction Act was passed, what Congress had in mind at that time was the fact that there was a discrimination against state.
But they limited it to injunction.
Yes, sir. But the
They could have said the federal court shall take no action on state tax cases.
That's right.
But they didn't. They limited it to injunction.
But they limited it to injunction, but Judge, the court has extended it to declaratory judgments. The courts have extended the declaratory judgments, and I think if Congress
so
had the...
eventually we'll extend it to probate.
Possibly, yes, sir. And we feel...
Can a declaratory judgment become a predicate for a money damage judgment?
It could, yes, Judge, yes. And
not
under
only
civil...
that, to get damages, you certainly are going to have a judgment that this assessment system is illegal.
Yes, sir. You'd first have to have, like, a declaratory judgment saying that this act or this act or some statute is unconstitutional.
May I disagree that you don't need a declaratory judgment to recover actions on a case that asks for damages? You can get damages without a declaratory judgment, can't you?
Well, Judge,
when you sue for damages, can't you get it without a declaratory judgment?
I don't, yes, sir, but
can't you?
Yes,
can't
sir.
You? I thought so.
Yes, sir, you could, but
I don't want to have to give back a whole lot of judgments out there.
You can't get damages without a judgment.
You've got to have a judgment.
I said declaratory.
Yes, sir.
That's what you both said.
I declaratory. Said I said judgment.
Well, take declaratory out.
In this case, I think before, under these facts, which was a motion to dismiss, this is here on a motion to dismiss, no question about it. There were two sets of defendants here. One, the county defendants, the county assessor, the county collector of revenue, and the county executive. There's also a set of defendants of the Missouri State Tax Commission. Now, Missouri State Tax Commission filed an answer. I call them the state defendants. The county defendants filed a motion to dismiss on comity and the Tax Injunction Act. And Judge Nangle sustained that motion to dismiss. And that's why we were here, on the motion to dismiss. Judge, I might point out that the Breckenridge case was decided on a motion to dismiss. It had never been tried. It came back on a motion to dismiss. And we submit that, Judge, before any damages could be sustained in this case, we submit that the trial court, the district judge, first is going to have to go into the manner of assessment. How the assessment was arrived at compared to new home to old home, and how it was applied. And then we submit them. Then you're getting into the attacks, an attack on tax assessment. And this court, as well as all other federal courts, the history has been that they have deferred to the state courts. They say you have a plain, speedy, efficient remedy in the state courts. You take your matter to the state courts. Don't come to the federal courts. That's been the history, even before the Tax Injunction Act. And we submit that since that Tax Injunction Act, that the courts have, they started out, yes, sir, with injunction suits, but then they've gone to declaratory judgment suits, they've gone to tax refund suits. The Ninth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit have said that on a tax refund suit, there was no such thing as a tax refund suit as far as when the Tax Injunction Act was passed, but they, in those two circuits, they have said that what Congress intended, what the federal courts have done in the past, we now extend to a tax refund suit, and therefore the Tax Injunction Act would bar it.
You don't need the Tax Injunction. In your argument, you don't need
that's,
it.
No, sir, we wouldn't, right. But we do have it.
And you didn't urge it. The court just took it.
No, so it was one of our motions to dismiss. It was based upon this. Yes, sir.
It was?
Yes, sir.
I thought it was on comity.
No, sir. That's what the court found on both of them.
Oh, I see.
Judge Nangles.
But you'd be satisfied with comity, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir. We'd be satisfied with the tax
refund
or comity.
What is the? There is a refund remedy, is there in under Missouri? Practice?
Yes, sir. There is a.
What is it that you have to pay your tax?
You pay your tax under protest, and with 90 days you file a suit in the circuit court, and at that point we say, besides that, they take an appeal to the County Board of Equalization, to the State Tax Commission. And we submit that that is their plain, speedy, and efficient remedy at law, which the tax injunction
said that they
have. Does that
commission have the authority to decide the constitutional question of whether the classification is?
I think they're yes, sir, Judge, yes. That's how the Breckinridge case went up, was on a tax protest case.
If instead of this being a discrimination between new homeowners and old homeowners, the discrimination was based in, say, racial classification or national origin or something like that, and there's an allegation that all the persons of a given race were assessed at a different basis, and that was state policy and so forth, you'd still say that claim had to be asserted in the state court.
Yes, sir, because, Judge, I think the Tax Injunction Act would come in for this reason. I don't believe that there's any way that you could arrive at that decision without going in to the matter of assessment. You'd have to do it.
Well, the only issue would be whether the principle of taxing at different rates because, A, in this case, they're new homeowners as opposed to old,
yes,
or in the other case, because they're members of race A instead of race B, that principle is either right or wrong. You couldn't raise that issue at all in a federal court under your view.
That's right, Judge, because of the fact, I think, Bland versus McCain, I think that was a case in which they, of course, that was an injunction case and for damages. And that was one of their allegations, that because of their race and because of the demonstrations, that their property taxes had assessment had been increased. But the court says, we have to inquire into the method of assessment. And because we have to inquire to the method of assessment, then the Tax Injunction Act comes into play and would bar the cause of action.
Well, Mr. Whaley, you rely primarily on the tax injunction, 1341,
yes, sir,
as barring this 1983 suit for damages.
Yes, sir.
Have you any other ground for barring jurisdiction of the federal court?
I think on the question of comity, deferring to the court, and I think
is that jurisdictional? Comity?
Sir?
Is comity jurisdictional?
Well, I think Judge Nanga was saying that because of the history of the federal courts deferring questions of state taxation to the state courts, then that's where they should be. Even though we have the Tax Injunction Act, they still should be in the state court.
That's pre-1341. There was a federal principle to stay out of state tax cases. But that was equity.
I'm sorry, sir?
That was equity, wasn't it?
That was equity, yes, sir. But he was extended saying, well, since that has been the history, and that has been, as the court said in Bland versus McHane, the longstanding judicial policy and congressional restriction of federal jurisdiction in cases involving state tax administration makes it the duty of federal courts to withhold relief. And I think that's what Judge Nangle had, the longstanding policy of the federal courts and congressional restraint. And I take it
you'd be willing to win this case on either ground.
Oh, yes, sir. I think either grounds would apply, Judge. Yes.
Why do you think the Eighth Circuit found it so difficult to divide it equally?
That I don't know. I can't answer that, Judge. I know they did not come down with any opinion, so we don't know.
But they expressed, and I think it's fairly unusual, they expressed their division.
Yes, sir.
And didn't hide it behind a general statement of an equally divided court.
I believe, Judge, the only thing it might be speculation on my part, is right before that, the court came, I think it was the Seventh Circuit, came out with the Fulton Market case, in which they permitted a damage suit under 1983 and said that the Tax Injunction Act wouldn't bar it. And I said possibly four of the judges on the Eighth Circuit thought maybe they should follow that, and four of them, I think, distinguished it, and I think it can be distinguished. I don't think it's applicable in this case.
Was Monroe and Pape argued in the Eighth Circuit?
I'm sorry, what?
Was Monroe and Pape argued in the Eighth Circuit?
That, I'm going to have to say, Judge, I'm not sure if they were or not.
Oh, what, this one?
Mr. Whirley, I take it one other question.
This is the one.
If I may,
was it argued in this case?
Do I correctly assume that, in your view anyway, that your opposition does not take the position that the state remedy is inadequate in any way?
Also, we say that the state remedy is adequate. Yes,
and do they agree with you on that?
Well, I know that for 2 years they have appealed their state that's still pending. 2 years they did not. 75 and 76 they did not appeal. On 78 and 79 they have appealed. So I assume that they would feel it is adequate.
I should ask them, but I wanted to get your impression.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Worley?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you agree that Congress simply wasn't thinking of a damages suit under Section 1983 when it enacted the Tax Injunction Act?
I would have to say sort of a qualified yes, because at that time, I think all you had in the federal courts were injunction actions.
Right.
And I don't think they thought sitting back then that somewhere along the line, maybe back in 1981, that somebody is going to come in and ask for damages. because what they were doing, in my opinion, they were putting into to a statute what the federal courts had been doing. They were concerned, I believe, about a number of things, and I think one of the things they were concerned about was, at that time, cases against local officials. But since there had not been that type of action, only injunction suits, I think that's why they worded it the way they did. But I think we must look at the fact that it was taken after the Johnson Act. As we state in our brief, it was almost the exact word of the Johnson Act, and there's no question, I don't think, about that act. It was a complete bar to any case filed in the federal district court in regard to a administrative agency setting utility rates in the states. And when we look at that history and we see that that was the act that the Tax Injunction Act was patterned after, then I don't think there's any question. And when we look at the reports that came out of the Senate and the House, they didn't just say the reports say that this is an action where the federal district courts cannot enjoin. They said this is going to apply to the jurisdiction of the federal courts. And I submit that when you look at and what Senator Bone said in regard to it, because he was a sponsor, and he read from the Johnson Act in his statement to Congress, and he said this act is patterned after that one. So we look at that history, and we look at the intent, then I think, and then what the federal courts have done over the years.
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask you, Mr. Worley, right there, what the federal courts have done. In the reply brief, I haven't read the cases, but your opponent on page 16 cites some cases in which he says in diversity cases, the federal courts had rendered damage awards in prior to the enactment of the statute, and that should be taken into consideration.
Judge, I think if you read those cases, they were applying state law.
Well, but they were allowing, they were damage, there was federal jurisdiction to enter a damage judgment, even if it was applying state law.
Yes,
we don't have an issue about what kind
we
of
had,
law.
They were applying state law, but
and the objection in the Tax Injunction Act was to enjoin even in diversity cases applying state law.
Yes, sir.
And they limited the statute to the injunction remedy because they were concerned about the federal courts interpreting the state law and giving that remedy.
Right. But most of those, I think you see, they call them damages, they were refund actions, but now we have some of these circuits that actually have held that the Tax Injunction Act applies even on refund actions. I think it's the case in California where the court said that this is an effective tax.
No, I was just questioning your analysis of the state of the law at the time the statute was passed, is all. And apparently there were precedents at that time for federal courts
in
both enjoining and granting monetary relief, and Congress clearly foreclosed further injunctive release, but didn't, at least not as clearly foreclosed.
Not as clearly, but I don't think they felt it. I think Congress knew at that time that there were suits under state law for state refunds, but I don't think they felt at that time there was going to be, say, a civil rights action brought against a state official. And I think
if I understood you answer an earlier question of mine, Mr. Worley, you take the position that the Tax Injunction Act barred not only injunction suits, but also, and the Congress intended also to bar, by the Tax Injunction Act, damage suits, don't you? Isn't that your position?
Yes, sir. But see, those cases were not based upon a federal statute. They were based upon state statute.
But neither were the injunction cases that had been previously decided. They were also based on state law.
Well, they weren't, not necessarily. They were.
Well, some of them were. The major difficulty that Congress was concerned with was foreign corporations coming in, having advantage of diversity jurisdiction, and getting injunctive relief under state law. They didn't want that.
Well, they were getting injunction relief from the federal court, though.
That's right. Well, these people are in federal court, too.
Yes, but I would still submit that the Tax Injunction Act, because of Congress's intention at the time, and what the federal courts have done, not even before and since then, have extended it from. We go from injunction, you know, to declaratory judgment, to refund, and then we come to damage suits. And I submit that when we look at the cases that have been decided in your various circuits, we look at the case involving the Lundman case out of the city of Cambridge, and we're talking about suits for declaratory judgments. When they said that, you know, declaratory judgment action as well as his damage claim, is predicated upon the invalidity of the assessment. And it's in assessments and attack upon the tax assessment, then they say that the Tax Injunction Act would be a bar even though it is brought under 1983. And we look at the case involving it's a district court case, but the advertiser case against Governor Wallace. And that was a damage suit, strictly a damage suit. And the court down there said, and let me just quote just a moment from that. The same principles which preclude awarding anticipatory relief or a refund should also preclude an award of damages sought in this case. They say the damage award plaintiff seeks, especially its request for punitive damages, still is designed to deter collection of the taxes now being assessed by defendants. And I think that we submit that when we're talking about this cause of action, that if it has any deterrent effect upon the assessment, the collection, or the levy of taxes by state officials or by county officials, because the county officials are the one who, in the first instance, did the things they complain about, then I think that what was said in the advertiser is true. It's designed to deter the collection of taxes being assessed by defendants. And we submit that even though it was an 8-8, we submit that what Judge Nangle held in his decision when he said that he would have, in effect, become an appellate court for appeals from the local tax assessor if he had to hear this case. We submit that he is correct, he's right, and we look at the language of the state of the Tax Injunction Act, we look at the legislative history, we look at what the courts have done prior to it and since then, and we submit to this court that Judge Nangle should be affirmed in this case. Yes, sir.
In this record that's put in on behalf of the defendants to explain the reason, if there is one, for the classification that they challenge, that is the distinction between new homes and older homes?
As Mr. Neuberger said, there had not been a reassessment of the all property in St. Louis County till sometime in the 60s. The new homes, so it's, I don't know how you look at it, Judge, you could say so the homes are being assessed at 33 and a third. Of their market value. But because of inflation, the value had gone up. All homes are assessed at 33 and a third. And the new homes came on at their market value, and they're assessed at 33 and a third. The appeal to the Board of Equalization, they reduced the assessment. Now, under Missouri law, the assessor is to assess property at 33 and a third. And so that is why the assessor was faced with this. Under Missouri law, I must assess property at 33 and a third percent of its true market value. Now, even though the Board of Equalization reduced that percentage last year, I think I must follow state law. And that is why he put it back at 33 and a third, because he must do that under state law. And the notice goes out because that gives them a chance to, they have under state law, they must be notified if their assessments increase. So they would have a right and time to take an appeal to the Board of Equalization or the State Tax Commission.
Incidentally, this does not apply to taxes within the city of St. Louis, this case.
No, sir. St. Louis County and St. Louis City are two separate entities.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Neuberger?
Thank you, Your Honor. There are a couple of points that I would like to specifically address that the justices raised in the course of the argument. If I might, Justice O'Connor, address the question that you asked first, don't we think that Congress really wasn't thinking about injunctions? I must admit that there are two answers to that. First of all, we have specified these two cases at page 16 of the reply brief in which the courts quite clearly took the view that a damage action could be brought. I think that Congress could have found those cases, whether they found them or didn't, I don't know. But that leads me perhaps to the second most important portion of the answer to that question, and that is that Congress very clearly established the jurisdictional bar and specified with specific words what the jurisdictional bar was going to be. The jurisdictional bar was against actions, or suits rather, to enjoin, suspend, or restrain. It says nothing about actions for damages. I think the language of the statute is terribly plain, and under those circumstances, I think if the bar is to be extended because of policy considerations, that it should be extended by Congress and not the court. That brings me to the question that Justice Blackmun raised. What speculation can one have for why the Eighth Circuit evenly divided on the question? And I think that if I may, will exercise the discretion to speculate myself. I think that the telling argument that makes the case terribly convincing on behalf of petitioners is that there is no precedent in the comity cases And there is no way to read the Tax Injunction Act to draw the conclusion that this action should be barred. The comedy cases have confined themselves to areas of equity. This is not an equity action. The Tax Injunction Act, as I suggest, is plain on its face. Well, what was the concern? Why was it a 4-4 split? I submit that the reason that it's a 4-4 split is because we are raising a troublesome question. We are suggesting that the federal courts in some way may become involved in reviewing what's going on in the state assessment processes. I submit that that concern, however, was overstated or over-worried in the Eighth Circuit for these reasons. First of all, this is not an effort to take money from the state coffers. It's an action against individuals. Second, there is all kinds of good faith defenses that are available if we get to the merits and we can't prove what we're saying.
Don't you agree, though, that in the course of your litigation to succeed, you're going to have to prove that the assessment was illegal?
That's right.
That it violated the Equal Protection Clause.
Two answers to that. First of all, as far as the second claim for relief is concerned, that I won't have to prove that. The second claim being this computer letter that automatically kicked people up. As far as the first claim for relief is concerned, I will have to show that the classification that occurred was palpably arbitrary.
And have a judgment of the court that it violated the Equal Protection Clause.
That's right, Your Honor. But the point that I would make in light of that, when one talks about our worrying about being in the state processes, if what we are going for is simply a new political process or a new policy process within the state, we would not undertake the burden of proving palpably arbitrary classification. The question, if we are going to the future policy of what's going to go on to the state, we will do that in the state courts. We have done that in the state courts. What we're saying here is that in the course of these of going through the process of raising the question in the state courts, these people became mad at us, and they took out after us. And in the course of doing that, they violated our constitutional rights. And that we have a right under Section 1983 to obtain the federal court protection of our constitutional rights if we can show that they purposely set about to violate those rights. If we can't prove that, then we can't prevail. We ask the court to send this back to give us our day in court so that we can demonstrate that we can indeed prove that. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.